The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Buenas, buenas, mis amores. This is Vico Ortiz, host of Date My Abuelita First. Each week, myself, alongside our resident abuelita, Liliana Montenegro.
Esa soy yo.
Play matchmaker for a group of hopeful romantics in this fun, flirty, and hilarious game show. Let's see if chispas will fly or if these singles will be sent back to the dating apps. Listen to Date My Abuelita First on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
So this is part two of a two-parter. And in part one, we talked about the life of William Morgan. He lived in Batavia, New York with his family in the mid-1820s when he decided that he was going to write an exposé of the Masonic Order and, as a consequence, gained the ire of many Freemasons. He was, according to witness accounts, abducted on September 11, 1826 and was taken to Fort Niagara, and his friends and family never saw him again. And his disappearance led to immediate criticism of the Freemasons, and volunteer investigators sought to figure out what had actually happened to William Morgan. A body found a year later was determined to be his, but then was identified as another man, so the mystery remained. So today we're picking up by talking about Morgan's book and what secrets it actually held, and the various confessions and accounts of Morgan's fate that were published in the decades following his abduction.
So Morgan's publishing partner, Colonel Miller, did publish Morgan's manuscript, although it wasn't as complete as Morgan had intended. He had planned to include the details on how a member would pass through the seven first degrees, but the manuscript Miller published included only three. The publisher wrote a lengthy introduction for it himself. Quote, "We come to lay before the world the claims of an institution which has been sanctioned by ages, venerated for wisdom, exalted for light, but an institution whose benefits have always been overrated and whose continuance is not in the slightest degree necessary. Strip it of its borrowed trappings, and it is a mere nothing, a toy not now worthy the notice of a child to sport with." Miller goes on to make the case that Masonry had value when knowledge was held in but a few places, and the order was needed as a, quote, guide and conductor, but that Masonry and its members no longer had any valuable knowledge which was not, quote, known to every inquiring mind. He points out that its origin was with workmen who were joining together to ensure their trades were regulated, but it became something else over the years, noting, quote, "But that there is anything intrinsically valuable in the signs, symbols, or words of Masonry, no man of sense will contend. That there is not any hidden secret which operates as a talismanic charm on its possessors, every man of intelligence, Mason or no Mason, must candidly acknowledge." Perhaps the most damning is Miller's passage, quote, "Masonry is of itself naked and worthless. It consists of gleanings from the Holy Scriptures and from the arts and sciences which shone in the world. Linking itself with philosophy and science and religion, on this it rests all its claims to veneration and respect. Take away this borrowed aid and it falls into ruins."
So if you're wondering what salacious secrets this book held, prepare to be disappointed. It does exactly what Miller says. It starts by laying out the opening ceremonies of the lodge, starting with the call to order and the call and response, which starts meetings consisting of the lodge master asking the people in various positions what their duties are and having them state them. It then details the manner in which a new initiate would be brought into the lodge, voted on, and initiated if that vote passed.
It includes the various steps of the ceremony, which have particulars that make them unique and ritualized, but really are generally pretty benign. There's the bringing forward of candidates to the order, their statements of intent, and voting on whether to initiate them. There's a part where the candidate's clothes are removed, and the candidate wears only his shirt, a borrowed pair of trousers that the lodge kept for the occasion, a blindfold, a slipper on his right foot only, and a rope around his neck and sometimes left arm. All of these are explained as symbolic of things like humility and trust and other traits like that. There's a promise of secrecy forever. And then, according to this document, the men would stand in a circle and clap their hands and stamp their right foot.
And then the three great lights of the order are introduced. The Holy Bible is invoked as a guide for faith, a square like a stonemason or a carpenter would use to square their actions, and a compass to keep the brothers in due bonds with all mankind, but especially brethren. And then there are three burning candles called the Lesser Lights, representing the sun as the ruler of the day, the moon as the ruler of the night, and the worshipful master as ruler of the lodge. All of the language throughout this ceremony, as William Morgan wrote it, is about honor and uprightness and keeping Christian values and befriending all brothers and helping them when in need, etc.
The book then describes the closing of the lodge with a similar call and response ceremony, including a prayer. And then the text goes into detail on all various symbols and their meanings, how the lodge is a representation of King Solomon's temple, and a lot of the passages that members studied and memorized to participate in these rituals.
There is a section that describes being promoted to the second degree of masonry, and it's not all that different from the initiation. There's more swearing of duty and recitation of call and response questions and discussions of the meanings of the symbols and what they represent, and even deeper commitment on the part of the member being promoted. The same write-up of the third degree, the Master Mason's degree, and how it is conferred is also, again, pretty similar. This one, though, involves travel, we're using air quotes there, which is really the promotee leaving and returning to the lodge and each time being told it's a new place. And once again, there's a call and response. There's a little bit of hazing type behavior along the lines of carrying him around in a blanket and pretending that he's being buried in a play acting farce involving Solomon and the death of the character Hiram Abriff, who is the architect of Solomon's temple. All of these rituals involve an awful lot of pontificating. Morgan writes of these ceremonies, quote, "The ceremonies, history, and the lecture in the preceding degree are so similar that perhaps some of the three might have been dispensed with."
The conclusion of the book is almost like a glossary, a list with all the various grips and hand signals and words, as well as arrangements of props that are part of the life of a lodge. This book is really not exactly shocking. It's mostly just a lot of rhetoric and kind of made-up lore, promises that members will have each other's backs. Nothing in it seems worth killing someone to protect. And this is particularly the case when you consider that there were already published books that already told Masonry's secrets. In his 1899 book, A Standard History of Freemasonry in the State of New York, author Peter Ross notes a handful of similar books that had been published in England as far back as 1724. And that a book titled Masonry Dissected, which was written by Samuel Pritchard in 1730, had a lot of reprints and was very popular in North America. And no doubt, because of this whole abduction and the fallout from it, Morgan's book was also very popular.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you read it expecting like some really dark secret will be revealed. And it's kind of like, huh. It's just a bunch of guys kind of telling ritualized Bible stories. This story stayed in the public eye for decades after Morgan's abduction and disappearance, both because it was a horrific event And because as members of the Batavia community and surrounding areas wrote their memoirs near the ends of their lives, they sometimes divulged their own knowledge of what had happened. Here's the thing. Those accounts are impossible to verify because of both the time that has elapsed since the accounts and since the matters discussed, and because everything about who knew what and participated was intended to be secret to begin with.
One of these accounts was written by Thurlow Weed in 1875. So that was nearly 50 years after Morgan's abduction. Weed was also anti-Masonic. So there's that context there. He stated that he had originally been asked to print the manuscript, but had refused on the basis that he felt Morgan was breaking his vow to keep the order's secrets. He also stated that the original plan for William Morgan was that he was going to be transferred to a Canadian lodge and then moved west in that country and given a job in a fur company there to try to keep him away from the Batavia community and the lodge that felt so threatened by this manuscript. But he said the Canadian lodge had changed their mind once this whole kidnapping was in motion, and that was why Morgan and his captors returned to Fort Niagara.
Weed names several men who he says then, as a group, were active participants in Morgan's end, meaning his murder. But Weed is pretty delicate in his language to not come out and say that they murdered him. He also wrote of these men that they were, quote, all men of correct habits and good character, and all, I doubt not, were moved by an enthusiastic but most misguided sense of duty. He continues later in his account, quote, of all the persons connected with the abduction, arrest, imprisonment, and subsequent fate of Morgan, there was not one within my knowledge who did not possess and enjoy the respect and confidence of his fellow citizens. It was not strange, therefore, that facts subsequently established beyond denial were at first very generally and indignantly rejected. The people would not believe that respectable citizens were guilty of open and gross violations of law. Weed also hinted in this book, and many people believed that he would relay even more specifics of what had happened to William Morgan one day.
Coming up, we'll talk about a different account that came out almost 50 years after the abduction. But before we do, we will take a quick sponsor break.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox,
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
So we talked about Thurlow Weed's account that he wrote in the 1870s. Another decades later account of what had happened to William Morgan was published in 1873. That was Samuel Green's book titled The Broken Seal, or Personal Reminiscences of the Morgan Abduction and Murder. In the introduction, Green writes, quote, "I have no intention of writing an autobiography, except in relation to one feature of my history. Many years ago, I was brought, in the providence of God, into strange and intimate association with a series of events which deeply affected my own mind and for a long time powerfully agitated society." Green explains that he was in the same lodge with Morgan and witnessed, quote, "much that went concerning him." And he says that he is prepared to bear testimony on the subject that few other men could give. He also states plainly that he has come to believe that Freemasonry is injurious to morality, hostile to good government, and also hostile to the Christian church.
Green mentions that, like him, other members of the Freemasons had found it to be corrupt and immoral and were distancing themselves even before the events related to William Morgan. He writes about colleagues who, speaking to other Masons about Morgan, found them to be very ready to justify what had happened to him. We mentioned that there was a rupture among the Masons in the aftermath of this abduction and disappearance, and this was a big part of it, although the fracturing had really already begun. Many saw this as the last straw in their association with the group. Green states that he doesn't think that the men who became members of the organization are inherently evil, but they became part of, quote, "an institution which has its own laws and its own methods of working, and by it they are shaped and controlled in ways they know not of." He makes the case that setting up any society as secret and separate from the rest of society is just inherently problematic and is sure to lead to corruption by degrees so subtle that its members don't even realize it's happening.
Green lays out the same details of Morgan's abduction that we've already discussed, but he also offers a sad revelation about halfway through the book, which reads, quote, "I was still a Mason in good and regular standing. Some might suspect me not to be true to my oaths, but my secret was not yet out. I still attended the lodge meetings, for I could not very well do otherwise just now. There I heard enough after a little time to convince me that Morgan was no longer in the land of the living. It was just as well understood by the members of our lodge that Morgan was dead as it is when our families attend a funeral of any person and return to tell the news. Only the Masons did not make the announcement in the same way. They had a great deal of rough joking over the subject, implying that he was drowned somewhere in the direction of Canada." Green's account states that lodge leadership clearly, quote, "understood well that Morgan had been put out of the way."
By some accounts, there were as many as 69 people involved in the plot to stop William Morgan from publishing his book. From the beginning of the plot, as it was hatched in a tavern owned by a man named Ganson, there were Masons from Batavia, Canandaigua, Lockport, Lewiston, and other towns and villages in western New York. So while it may have been the work of only some of the order, it was a significant number of people. How many of them knew that things would escalate from organized harassment to kidnapping to murder is really unknown, and it could be that different pockets of the group knew differing degrees of the plan and were willing to go to different lengths to try to secure their secrecy. There's also a theory that the plot was purposely doled out in pieces in the interest of maintaining deniability.
The remains that we mentioned in the opening of part one were found in 1881 in Pembroke, New York, about 11 miles west of Batavia. That was during a dig project that was to precede the establishment of a stone quarry on the site. Initially, the men working on that dig thought that they had uncovered the remains of a Native American because the site of the planned quarry was just 2 miles away from the Tonawanda Reservation. But there wasn't anything on or with the body that supported that idea. That body had been covered with rocks and dirt. This was not a scenario where a body had been accidentally buried over time. All evidence indicated it had been deliberately buried with the intent to conceal it.
This is a case where the unearthing of the body might make you cringe because it really wasn't handled with the sort of careful techniques that ideally would be used today. The workmen who found the remains removed the bones. According to the paper, it was carefully. They set them aside and then started sifting through the dirt with their hands. Ideal or not, this method did turn up some other clues. There was a silver ring with the monogram WM engraved on it. And then what was believed to have been an old tin tobacco box, which contained a manuscript.
While there was agreement that the initials WM on the ring were not conclusive, because a lot of people have those initials, the manuscript was recognized as potentially important, and it was taken to a man the papers referred to simply as Dr. Phillips, who examined it under a microscope to see if they could make out any of the very faded writing on it. Basically, like, to the naked eye, you couldn't tell what any of the words were. And he was reportedly able to identify the following words: Masons, liar, prison, kill, and the name Henry Brown.
Henry Brown was a lawyer in Batavia who wrote a book 3 years after Morgan vanished, titled A Narrative of the Anti-Masonic Excitement in the Western Part of the State of New York during the years 1826-78 and a part of 1829. This book seems like it's on Morgan's side in some ways. It describes him being abducted in great detail and says it was overzealous Masons who had done this, but it also asserts that there was no proof of a murder taking place. And then it kind of chides William Morgan for having gotten everybody so riled up in the first place by writing his book.
At this point, with this new body discovered, at least one member of the press hunted down William Morgan's adult daughter for comment. The New York Times reported on July 9, 1881, that Mrs. Smith, who was married to Captain William Smith and was living in Portland, Oregon, quote, says her father was drowned by five men who took him one night into the lake. She states that one of the five men who assisted in the drowning for many years resided in Portland, Oregon, but is now dead.
Just a few weeks later, on July 22, 1881, the New York Times ran a piece titled Another Morgan Story. It is, in essence, an obituary claiming that William Morgan had died in Smyrna, Turkey, known today as Izmir. This item's subtitle kind of sets up the tone for the piece. Quote, the much drowned and off-killed man dies in Smyrna. The timing of the reported death is a little unclear. It's one of many accounts that claims that this information came from an old-timer who has since passed on, although it does say that he heard the story in 1849.
A year after the 1881 discovery of remains, William Morgan got a monument, which was viewed with some suspicion. And we'll talk about that after we hear from our sponsors.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together. We'll cry together and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1882, a monument to William Morgan was erected by an anti-Mason group called the National Christian Association. This group was new, and it incited some suspicious speculation. The New York Times wrote of the monument on September 15, 1882, quote, "To most people, the fact of the existence of a National Christian Association was made known for the first time the other day by the unveiling of a statue erected by the association in honor of one William Morgan."
This article reflects the negative sentiment that still surrounded Morgan 56 years after his death. It continues in the language of a smear campaign sounding surprisingly angry. Quote, "At first sight, it may seem rather odd that a National Christian Association should take pains to honor the memory of a drunken vagabond whose one claim to fame lies in the fact that he violated a dozen or more of the most solemn oaths or told a large collection of ingenious falsehoods. To add to the beauty and symmetry of his moral character, Mr. William Morgan always maintained that he violated his alleged oaths and betrayed the confidence of his associates from a sense of duty. He thus crowned his moral edifice with hypocrisy and was as various and miscellaneous a rascal as our prolific country had produced." This article then goes on to exaggerate the anti-Mason stance for effect, sort of blaming every ill of the world on the fraternity as a means to discredit the stance of the National Christian Association by noting how utterly harmless all Freemasons look while talking about their alleged bloodthirstiness. This is kind of an intense read.
It really is. It's so angry for something that is half a century old. The discovery of the WM body led to more people asking for Thurlow Weed to finally tell everything he knew, if in fact there was more to his story, as he had hinted in 1875. At this point, he was the only surviving person with ties to the case. And in 1882, he did write another follow-up to the story. He included the fact that he had left Rochester and the paper that he ran there after sentiment against him grew in the wake of calling for Freemasons to, quote, take the laboring oar in the search for Morgan. Subscriptions to his paper dropped so rapidly after he had made this statement that he left the paper to his business partner and just sought work elsewhere.
In his follow-up, Weed comments on the fact that three of the men who were part of the volunteer committee that formed in Rochester to investigate Morgan's abduction back in 1826 had been Masons themselves, and that two of them had been involved in the abduction. He mentions that the legal efforts to bring the perpetrators to justice in multiple different municipalities were all hindered by the fact that Masons in each community were protecting each other and the order, and that obtaining indictments had been impossible, quote, in 5 of the 6 counties where indictments were needed. In discussing the evidence, he noted, quote, there was every reason to believe that he was taken from the magazine and drowned in Lake Ontario. This, however, was boldly and persistently denied. Denials accompanied by solemn assurances that Morgan had been seen alive in several places divided the public sentiment.
Weed noted that while this issue led to political positioning as parties being pro or anti-Mason, he and his committee, quote, firmly resisted all efforts, urging all who were connected with us in an effort to vindicate the law to vote for the candidates of the party with which they had been previously connected. But he explained that once it was discovered that Masons had enough power to control the outcome of elections and pretty much everything else, he and like-minded colleagues incorporated their anti-Mason stance into their politics. Weed was a politician. He was a member of the New York State Assembly the year before Morgan's disappearance, and he was elected a member again in 1830.
Through an account he attributed to a man named John Whitney, who was involved in the plot, Weed ultimately placed the blame for the initial idea to stop Morgan's book through kidnapping on David Johns. And then he implicates several other Masons as he described the confession that one gave him of the end of Morgan's life. According to that account, which Weed stated he never shared because it was told to him in confidence, Morgan was told he was being taken to Canada and that his family was going to be brought to him there, so he willingly got into a boat. And that at the mouth of the Niagara River, a rope was tied around him with a sinker attached to him, and he was dumped. In a particularly sad detail, he tried to hold on to the edges of the vessel but was pushed away, and he managed to bite one of his killers in the process. Weed gives a complicated story about why he did not obtain a signed copy of this confession. He said that Whitney wanted one to be made to be shared after his death, but that Weed was so busy, he forgot to do it.
Yeah, there's a whole weird sidetrack story where he's like, oh, I was in town for a convention and I told him I would go do it, but I got so busy, I forgot about it. And then I went to Iowa and then I remember. Like, it's a very, like, here's the overly complicated and detailed explanation of why I don't have a signed version of this. The Whitney account was not the only late in life confession to the murder of William Morgan. There were others, but they created new problems, as in some cases the details did not match up among them. Additionally, and frustratingly, the remains that were found in 1881 never seemed to lead to any sort of conclusive revelation. That story just sputters out in the papers. So if people were hoping that Weed's second writing on the matter, one of the confessions, or the investigation of the body and its accoutrement would lead to a final resolution, they did not get it. And there never has been one. Even modern tellings of Morgan's story disagree deeply on what kind of man he was, whether this entire thing was a sinister plot, a case of a handful of people getting carried away by their zeal, or even a stunt created by Morgan and Miller to bolster sales of their book. But the majority seemed to chalk the whole thing up to zeal that went too far as it agitated among the men responsible for the abduction and likely end of Morgan's life.
In A Standard History of Freemasonry in the State of New York, which we've quoted in this episode previously, author Peter Ross, who we could not call a fan of William Morgan by any measure, makes the case for why this entire scenario escalated to such a tragic end. Quote, had it been proposed to issue the Illustrations of Masonry in a large city, it might, if we judge by previous instances, have created no comment. But in a little country place, it was different. Quite an excited sentiment against the proposed work was aroused, and the feeling was intensified by the worthlessness of its real or reputed author. Had it been a work of an honest man, which is difficult to realize, of an educated man or a thinker, it might have been viewed differently and with some degree of respect. But for a graceless, good-for-nothing scamp to propose selling secrets he had sworn to conceal for the prospect of a few dollars was too much to be regarded lightly. And as the matter was discussed, the rumors gathering in clearness of the nature of the work ascribed to it a merit far beyond its due and intensified the excitement. So this is both an insightful commentary on small communities and the way that strife can impact them, and a pretty biased description of William Morgan, also pretty victim blamey.
Oh, 100%. Samuel Green, who was far more sympathetic to Morgan, makes a similar statement in his book, quote, "Never were greater emotions awakened from so small and unimportant a cause." He then adds, quote, "But there was, nevertheless, a philosophy underlying this excitement. It must be remembered that Masonry is too sacred and important a thing to be committed to books. The theory is that it must be transmitted from generation to generation through the air, that the whole communication of these tremendous secrets must be purely oral, passing from mouth to mouth as the illustrious order lives along the ages." Humans.
Mm-hmm.
Always so disappointing. So for listener mail, I have one that's a correction. This is from our listener, Jenny, who writes about our Mad Gasser of Mattoon episode. Jenny writes, "Dear Holly and Tracy, I've been listening to the show for years now and love the broad array of topics you bring to light. I can proudly say that I have my PhD in stuff you missed in history class, although it is an ongoing job to maintain that degree, and I am now a couple of months behind." We always say this, but it bears repeating again. That's cool. I never want anybody to feel like... you know, listening to something they enjoy is an obligation and not something that's actually enjoyable.
I was about to say there's no obligation at all.
No.
Like,
we love our listeners and we love that you're listening, but like, we get behind on the media that we love all the time. It happens. Life is a thing that is full of activities and needs and responsibilities. Your entertainment should never feel like a responsibility. Jenny writes, I have wanted to write in for a long time, and I hate that I finally got around to it by pointing out a minor correction. In the Mattoon Gasser episode, you mentioned the Alton Railroad, pronouncing Alton, as it looks like how it should be pronounced, like the Food Network host Alton Brown. As this is my hometown, I feel compelled to let you know that it is actually pronounced Alton. Alton is in fact an interesting little river town that could provide material for the show someday. It is the site of the 7th Abraham Lincoln Douglas debate, the hometown of the record holder of the tallest man in the world, Robert Wadlow, the home of Elijah P. Lovejoy, the first martyr for the press, the birthplace of Miles Davis, site of the Piazza Bird legend, and unfortunately the home of Phyllis Schlafly. I would not have known Alton was pronounced that way, so thank you. Finally, attached is the obligatory pet tax. The reddish brown guy and black brown girl are my current babies, Ziggy and Melusine. I also feel I must include my pets who have sadly passed on, as they too heard plenty of hours of stuff you missed in history class with me. The smiling black dog is Achilles, so cute. The brown rabbit is Summer, also so cute. And the black one is Autumn. Bunnies make great pets and are really fun and loving. However, they can have a lot of health problems and are not as easy to care for as people expect. Unfortunately, this leads to people setting them free, which domesticated rabbits are not prepared to handle. But I digress. Thank you for all you do and keep up the good work. So we got a correction and a PSA about rabbits. If you want to adopt a rabbit, they're very cute. But yeah, they're all animals are work. You got to be prepared for the commitment of an animal. Thank you for that correction. Sorry, Alton. Didn't mean to do it wrong. If you would like to write to us with minor corrections, pet pictures, or your thoughts on unsolved but kind of solved murders, you can do that at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you have not yet subscribed, you can do that on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Buenas, buenas, mis amores. This is Vico Ortiz, host of Date My Abuelita First. Each week, myself, alongside our resident abuelita, Liliana Montenegro.
Esa soy yo!
Play matchmaker for a group of hopeful romantics in this fun, flirty, and hilarious game show. Let's see if chispas will fly or if these singles will be sent back to the dating apps. Listen to Date My Abuelita First on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.